We'll proceed to the fourth case of the day, the United States versus Pellman. Mr. Rowan.
May it please the court. I'm Attorney Brendan Rowan for the appellant. This case involves a violation of the Controlled Substances Act, or CSA. The Controlled Substances Act, as it relates to registered physicians, criminalizes their behavior if it falls outside of their professional practice and the actions are without a legitimate medical purpose. The jury must find, according to Chuby and Feingold, that the doctor intended to act as a drug pusher rather than as a medical professional. The appellant contends that specialized knowledge under the circumstances of this case was required before the jury could analyze the bulk of the evidence put in by the government. In this particular case, the appellant contends that an expert witness was required because in this case, unlike any of the other cases that were cited by either party, there is only one victim. So there's no pattern of conduct for the jury to analyze. There were 14,000 vials of fentanyl that were given to the patient over the span of 8 months. To a layperson, that seems like an incredibly significant amount of drugs. But when one looks at the fact that it's really only 1.4 grams of total fentanyl in 14,000 vials, it becomes much more difficult for a jury to analyze the significance of those 14,000 vials and to overcome, I think, the initial emotional response that that volume of drugs creates.
There were all kinds of surrounding circumstances that suggest the non-medical reason for this. I mean, the doses were administered not in the clinic, but at home or at her home, and without any record being made of the administration of this medication. It was outside the ordinary course of your client's practice, well outside the ordinary course of his practice, and the clinic staff testified that it was highly unusual. And then his stated reason, or at least the reason that he told investigating officers when questioned, didn't hold up.
Well, I think that on closer analysis, it does. This is a friend. So, yes, it is going to be different. He doesn't charge her like all of the other cases that were cited by either party. This is a case where the doctor had a nurse who was a long-term employee who he had been her primary physician for 5 years, and he treated her for trigeminal neuralgia, which is known as the suicide disease because the pain is so horrific, according to the record. He doesn't charge her. He does treat her at his home and at her home. But I think that that's not unusual when you're treating a friend without charge, that your record keeping isn't going to be the same, much like the way a lawyer may do a will for a friend and not open up a file, not charge them, may go to their home to visit with them where they would not do that for a traditional patient.
The cessation of narcotic medication is much
different. It is different, but there's no prohibition to doing that. In the Green case that we cited, said that sloppy record keeping is part of a technical violation that should not, and the Green case did not include that in their analysis of a legitimate medical practice, legitimate medical treatment. I think in this case, most of those deviations from the way he dealt with standard patients can be explained by the relationship between he and the patient. I mean, this is the only pro bono drug dealer that I'm aware of has ever been convicted underneath this statute. There is no other cases where only one patient is alleged. Dr. Pellman treated thousands of people. The government has gone into the way he treated one patient and said that your treatment is so egregious that you're no longer being a doctor, you're being a drug pusher. But yet no one came and told that jury what the extent of those narcotics are. Is 14,000 vials, which is, as I said, 1.4 grams of fentanyl delivered slowly over 8 months, how does a jury determine whether or not that's within the practice of legitimate medicine? The government does allege three essential bases for why they believe that no expert is needed. They say that the significance of the fentanyl, the fact that it was different than the other patients. Well, this particular patient had a diagnosis that none of the other patients had.
Made by whom?
Made by Dr. Pellman, an uncontested at trial, that she had this trigeminal neuralgia.
But he said to the investigators that he was treating her for dental pain.
Well, that had been incurred. Pain is what caused the trigeminal neuralgia. I'm assuming that when he's talking to an agent, he's not going to go into the formal medical diagnosis, assuming that when you tell somebody she's got trigeminal neuralgia, they have no idea what you're talking about. The trigeminal neuralgia was caused by a problem with a tooth extraction. The government then went on to cite poor record keeping. As I've said, I think poor record keeping is more within the realm of administrative penalties. The Green case specifically addressed that and found it to be a technical violation, not something that it used in its analysis of legitimate medical purpose.
There's also testimony from the oral surgeon that this was not a legitimate diagnosis.
No. Dr. Jensen was specifically asked by the government, do you agree with that diagnosis? And he said, that's outside my expertise. I'm not able to comment on whether that treatment was proper.
He did testify that she never exhibited any symptoms of it.
Right, but he said it's not his area of expertise. He wouldn't necessarily know, I assume, whether or not she was experiencing it or not. By his own testimony, it's not something he's familiar with.
And he also testified that he had no concerns about her pain management post-oral surgery?
He did. However, my client can only go based on what his patient is telling him. She's telling him, and no one disputes, that she's in significant pain. And no one disputes that the narcotics he provided her are pain-relieving narcotics. The last issue that the government raises is the home search and how narcotics and other equipment were found at both of their homes. Well, if he's treating both of them at the homes, that's only natural that he's going to find those drugs and those the equipment to administer those drugs at their homes.
But that's not the only evidence that was available. I mean, first of all, you've got morphine use by both the alleged victim here and by Pellman, correct?
Correct. Dr. Pellman did acknowledge self-medicating himself. And as to the best of my knowledge, that's not illegal to do that. I don't think that...
Well, but it's something the jury certainly would put into context when he's injecting himself and he's injecting his close friend in their homes. It starts to look a lot less like adequate medical treatment and more like addiction.
My concern is exactly that it does start to look like that. And when you show the jury pictures of 14,000 vials of fentanyl, the natural conclusion is that this isn't proper, this isn't right. But if you don't have a expert witness to explain that to a jury, how do they determine whether 1.4 grams of fentanyl is appropriate? How do they determine whether or not a doctor can self-medicate or can't self-medicate? I don't know. Personally, I don't know whether that's legal or not. And there's no way that a lay jury could possibly take those facts and make that determination properly. They need that specialized knowledge that only an expert can give them.
Does Pellman dispute that even after the victim went into detox, that he continued to prescribe medication?
No, because her trigeminal neuralgia continued to go. She was in there for dependence, which is common with opiates, is what he put in the record. But he continued to treat her. If he hadn't, he was, I don't know what his concerns were, but they were significant, that she still needed the opiate. She still had the pain on a daily basis. She was going to the dependency clinic in order to regulate the dependency that was related to the fentanyl and the morphine.
Even though the court had ordered her not to take it anymore?
The court had ordered her not to take it?
Wasn't that the...
The court ordered the doctor not to give it to her. I don't think the court ever ordered her not to take it.
But
she had to take it.
And he proceeded to do so?
Yes, that decision was made by Dr. Pellman.
How many doses of fentanyl and morphine a day?
I believe it varied. As the course of the treatment moved on, it was a different amount over varying time periods.
At the end, he apparently told the agents that it was 50 doses of fentanyl a day.
That could be. Now, he was, according to the record, giving her 2 milliliter vials. They're available up to 50. He was using the lowest dose. He could have given her the exact same amount of fentanyl with 560 doses. And that's where I'm concerned that the emotional impact of the 14,000 weighs so heavy on everyone, when in reality, without a doctor's analysis, there's no way to know it. I mean, a doctor may very well come in and say, that's crazy, 14,000 vials is absolutely over the top. A doctor may come and look at this and say, well, you could have done 12 fentanyl patches and gotten the exact same amount of fentanyl. This is actually very conservative.
It's just hard to overlook, you know, all of the. We're finding it in the cars. We're finding it in both homes. It's strewn about the empty I mean, it just doesn't look anything like medical treatment. It doesn't have anything to do with the volume. It's just the nature of it. And even after he's ordered by a court not to administer, he continues to do so. I'm not sure how much more help the jury needs from an expert to reach its conclusion.
In the other cases, an expert is looking at the fact that there's phony names being used on prescriptions, there's no exam, there's false documents put into file, doctors are charging by prescriptions. In this case, a jury is trying to determine whether 1.9 or 1.4 grams of fentanyl and morphine over 8 months is appropriate medical care. I agree there are a lot of these other circumstances, but without an understanding of the actual impact and import of the narcotics, there's no way to put all that in context. He's treating her at her home. So, yes, there's narcotics at her home. He's treating her at his home. There's narcotics at their home. It may be unconventional, but without an expert witness, we're looking at someone who clearly is making no money, who's treating one patient. There are no other cases like this that are out there. And all the other cases where no expert is needed, or no expert is determined to be needed by the court, you've got doctors who are doing between hundreds and thousands of prescriptions on a regular basis, making an incredible amount of money. Here you have a doctor who's doing things unconventionally, but nobody came to this jury and said that there's anything wrong with the narcotics that he issued in terms of the amount or the degree.
This is beyond unconventional, actually. The circumstantial evidence is very damning, it seems to me.
I think the emotional impact of a lot of the facts are damning. I think that a medical expert, though, is needed to determine whether the actual administration of narcotics is inappropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Rowland. Mr. Jacobs.
Please support. I'm Matt Jacobs, representing the United States. I also did handle the trial in this case. It is sort of an interesting intellectual question as to whether the government can ever be required to present expert testimony to prove an essential element. You know, I think it's similar to those cases where defendants argued we had to bring in an expert to prove that something was cocaine or a controlled substance, and clearly that's not the case. We can bring in addicts themselves or pushers or dealers to say this is controlled substance, this is cocaine, this is crack. But Dr. Pellman's argument is really challenging the sufficiency of the evidence is really based on a false premise or assumption that he was providing medical treatment or diagnosis to Ms. Evans. There is no credible evidence in the record that he was treating Ms. Evans. We have Dr. Pellman's claim that is completely unsupported, undocumented, and understandably rejected by the jury in this case. What we do have is evidence from Dr. Pellman himself and his staff about Dr. Pellman's practice. He's a radiologist. He never used morphine in his practice. He used small amounts of fentanyl. His patients received one or two vials of fentanyl per treatment. He recorded his acquisition of fentanyl. He actually never used morphine, so he never had to record it in his practice. He always recorded his use of fentanyl. He maintained patient files for all of his patients. He always documented his use of narcotics on patients. The treatment always happened at the clinic. He never provided drugs to patients to take home. And the use of narcotics and fentanyl was always supervised and monitored. And then we have Ms. Evans. We have substantial quantities compared to, on an annual basis, Dr. Pellman, prior to 2009, maybe ordered 250 vials of fentanyl a year. He ordered 14,000 vials in 2009 and provided virtually all of it, more than 90%, to Ms. Evans. He also ordered morphine, a drug never used, as testified by Dr. Pellman himself and his staff, never used in his practice, ordered it, administered to himself, administered it to Ms. Evans. Fentanyl, as Dr. Pellman described it, is a narcotic pain reliever 100 times more potent than morphine. He didn't record his acquisition of virtually all of the fentanyl. He didn't record any of his acquisition of the morphine that he gave to Ms. Evans. He didn't record his administering of any of the fentanyl to Ms. Evans. He provided the narcotics to Ms. Evans to allow her to take it home. He had it delivered to her home, and mathematically, he provided her more than 50 vials of fentanyl a day, every single day, from February till November of 2009. Supervised, it wasn't monitored, it was done at her home, and he mixed it, apparently, according to his testimony, mixed fentanyl and morphine together. There was no record of the frequency, the quantity, the mixture, the timing. There was no patient file for Ms. Evans, you know, not her weight, her height, her blood pressure, her symptoms. No record of his diagnosis.
But that's a dose every half an hour on a daily basis for 8 months?
I mean, again, that's just the mathematical average. And unfortunately, there was a conflict between the way Ms. Evans described how much she got. She says, well, it started off maybe one or two vials three times a week. But, of course, Dr. Pellman did the math. That doesn't work out. He can't explain how he gets 14,000 vials distributed over the nine-month period of time. So he does the math, and he says, no, almost from the beginning, I'm giving her 50 vials of fentanyl, 5 to 10 vials at a shot on an hourly basis, because he has to account for an average of 53 vials a day, every single day. And, you know, if the court, I think the record has the photographs. If the court looks at the photographs of Ms. Evans' residence, of Dr. Pellman's residence, what you see is much closer to a drug house than a clinic. There are thousands of empty vials scattered throughout the house. There are ashtrays full of full or empty vials of fentanyl. There's a bag of an IV bag hanging in her bathroom closet. There are nails above the bed in Dr. Pellman's house where they would hang IV bags to administer fentanyl or morphine to Ms. Evans. It's scattered everywhere. The kitchen, the garage, in her car, in her purse. At Dr. Pellman's house, there's an open bottle of morphine, a band to tie off someone's arm, and a used syringe with a needle. But really, the best evidence, I mean, obviously, from the government standpoint, I believe we had a lot of evidence, but the best evidence is really Dr. Pellman's behavior. DEA searches his clinic in November of 2009. They search his clinic. They search Ms. Evans' house. The DEA comes in with a search warrant. And what does he do for the next 2 months? He continues to give fentanyl to Ms. Evans. Ms. Evans goes into detox, goes to see a psychiatrist, receives Suboxone to help wean her off her opiate dependency, but there's Dr. Pellman still giving her fentanyl. And I think what Judge Conley was referring to is the second time they searched his clinic in January of 2010, he gets arrested. They search his clinic, he gets arrested, he gets released on bond, and is told not to prescribe any drugs for Ms. Evans. And what does he do? According to Ms. Evans, they meet it. She picks him up at the courthouse. They go to a hotel in Brookfield. He pays for it in cash, and he gives her more fentanyl. So, again, I think the jury understandably rejected his claim that he was treating Ms. Evans. They contradicted each other. They concealed the drug distribution from the treating physicians that treated Ms. Evans. There was, as I say, the obstruction is based on the fact that, again, Dr. Pellman is trying to claim, I'm treating her. So when the agents come in the door the first time, what he says is, I'm treating her in connection with her current oral surgeon. And he correctly identifies her correct oral surgeon, Dr. Jensen, and says, I've worked with him. He wants me to take care of her pain treatment. And, again, that's consistent with what he's claiming at trial, what he's claiming here on appeal, what he claimed to the investigators. I'm treating her. It's false. Dr. Jensen says, I don't even know Dr. Pellman. I didn't need to give her anything for pain. So, again, I think that, A, demonstrates the materiality of the false statement concerning Dr. Jensen, and then justifies the court's decision to
enhance. Mr. Jacobs, is there evidence that this investigation came about because of the disproportionate amount of ordering of drugs? Do we know that that's what caused this case to come to be?
No, actually, someone came to the DEA and said that he was giving out narcotics to Ms. Evans, and that prompted the DEA to look at it, and they said, you know, here's his history. He's hardly getting anything, and then, boom, it jumps.
Well, as you relate some of the facts, would you suggest we've got an addict doctor and an addict employee?
I think there's some type of codependency. I'm not sure what Dr. Pellman's addiction is. He's injecting himself, by his testimony, very small quantities of the morphine.
Well, I'm not making a conclusion on it. I'm just trying to read the government's need to remove him from the medical profession, much less indict him. Because you've got a doctor and a codependent, perhaps, employee and maybe a relationship beyond the traditional.
Right.
So it does present a kind of a factual situation. I'm speaking now, obviously, not to prosecutorial discretion as much as I am to sufficiency of the evidence on convicting him of a criminal offense of the kind of intent as opposed to violation of the narcotics, you know, the civil penalties that would attend a doctor who abused the act.
I think the duration, the extent, the volume of drugs we're talking about being distributed, the fact that we have a physician with his DEA registration ordering that large quantities of narcotics and then distributing it, as I say.
Well, but the evidence is distributing to who? To himself, perhaps, or to a degree, and to...
And to Ms. Evans.
And to Ms. Evans, and a removal from the profession and a four-year incarceration. Pretty damning scenario for somebody who perhaps didn't follow medical ethics and
I would say he was given a number of opportunities. You know, we went in first November 2009, and you think that would have said, okay, I'm making some mistakes, so I'm going to stop, and that's not what he did. So we're forced to go in again in January 2009, and again, he doesn't stop, and again, we find him doing it again. And in fact, again, this wasn't in the jury, but it happened again, even after he was released on bond.
The investigation never shows him, I suppose you have patient lists, any other patients.
Right. There was no one getting those type of quantities, although, again, because there's no record, we can assume that it all went to Ms. Evans.
No, I recognize that this doesn't sound like a traditional radiologist's practice to have this, and it just does present a kind of an unusual factual setting. I don't want to say sympathetic, but it may well be that the doctor chose the wrong course of conduct in responding to government inquiry. And,
if I may, just one question. Was the jury not apprised of his continuing to receive drugs, continuing to administer drugs after being ordered not to do so as a condition of release?
No.
I must have misread that.
He was asked. He actually denied it. He denied. He said he gave her something other than fentanyl. She testified it was fentanyl. But they were notified. There was somewhat restricted.
That there was a restriction.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Jacobs. Ms. Rowan, you had run out of time, but we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal if you wish.
I recognize that the facts and circumstances of this case are unusual. But I also think that it's important that you have here a doctor with no prior record who's made no money off of this. He's got no financial incentive
but
for anything.
It's not required that he make money, is it, to violate
no,
distribution?
No, but to the best of my knowledge, when the law says and the cases say you have to find that someone is essentially become a drug dealer, it is inconsistent with that description because there generally are no pro bono drug dealers out there.
Well, he had a very close personal relationship with Ms. Evans. I mean, she testified that she loved him, right?
And as a friend, correct.
Very close personal relationship with Ms. Evans, and that was before the jury. And also, there's evidence that he himself was an addict. And the circumstantial evidence certainly supports the inference that he was using on a significant level beyond what he was willing to admit on the witness stand, and that further supports the theory that what we have here is a junkie doctor and a close personal female friend who is also a junkie.
I guess maybe said another way, you're not arguing that there wasn't a sufficient basis to convict except for the absence of an expert to put the 50 vials a day in context.
I'm saying substantially what you're saying. I'm saying that with respect to the actual narcotic delivery, without a doctor, you cannot determine whether or not that's an excessive amount, whether 1.4 grams over 8 months is an excessive amount of fentanyl.
What about Mr. Rowan, what about the fact that this is a radiologist heavily involved in dispensing drugs? Now, I certainly don't want to suggest I know much about the field of radiology, but is this in keeping with his general focus of the general focus of his practice?
No, this is the only trigeminal neuralgia patient that he had, and he would not have treated someone off the street doing this, but he did it for a friend. Now, she worked for him for many years prior to any of this happening. This is not a situation, nor was there any evidence introduced at trial that there was a romantic relationship, nor did the government ever argue that Dr. Pellman was an addict.
The problem here is that your argument that expert testimony was required in this case in order to sustain this conviction depends on a factual premise that isn't present, and that factual premise is that there is some support for the legitimacy of this course of conduct, and there is almost zero evidentiary support for the legitimacy of this course of conduct.
Except for Mr. Pellman, and the jury obviously didn't believe him.
They didn't.
Well, it's almost incredible on its face.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you, Mr. Rowan, Mr. Jacobs. The case is taken under advisement.